Hello, and welcome to Technically Legal Podcast, episode 23 for November 3rd, 2009. My name is Ben Snickoff, and with me today I've got
Dominic Ravier
and David O'Brien.
We've got three great stories for you today. First of all, the Arizona Supreme Court said that metadata is part of a public record and has to be turned over according to their Public Records Act. The next case we have is that a court said that a personal notice is not required if the government wants to search your email. And thirdly, we've got Facebook scoring a big win in a canned spam case. So we'll discuss what all of that means as we get to them in turn. So we're going to start out with the Arizona case. So briefly, what happened in this case is we have a couple of people who filed suits independently looking for public records. And each of these people not only wanted the contents of the public record, what was initially said there, and you know what was typed in the public record, but they also wanted to know something that was stored in the metadata. Particularly in one case, it was when the document was originally created. One of these people thought that in this Arizona case that it was backdated, that somebody had typed up a document after the case and then moved it back in time. So, briefly, can somebody explain to me? I mean, generally, what else would we find in metadata? Is it just the time it was created?
You will find authorship information, who created it. Depending on the complexity of the file format, you might even have a full edit history involved. You'll have how many minutes were spent editing, all sorts of fun properties that could influence a case one way or another, especially if, for example, the metadata reveals that the document wasn't originally authored at the company that made it. So perhaps they're using somebody else's work and forgot to change the metadata.
Now, are you thinking of a specific case there, Dominic?
Not particularly, but I'm sure those facts have come up before.
Okay. David, you were going to say something?
Yeah, one of my favorite things when I talk about metadata to some of my colleagues is that if you're doing track changes when you're doing like group collaboration on a document, which often happens in legal practice, some forms, depending on what type of document, what type of productivity software you're using, whether it's Microsoft Word or whether it's Corel's WordPerfect or whatever, that metadata also often contains all of the comments that have been made, in addition to, I think Dominic mentioned, some of the deleted text and other versions of the track changes that you might have gone through before you finalized the document itself.
Right. I want to get back to that in a second. And I think that's really hitting on the more interesting point in all of this. The court in Arizona essentially said, you know, yes, the data was created and all that stuff that's typically associated with an electronic file, all of that stuff is part of the public record. There's no reason to think that it isn't. And you guys can turn it over. It's not complicated. You just hand over the original file. You don't have to go through some special process to, strip out the metadata and then print it out in an extra file. But what David is saying, I think, is, again, significantly more interesting point. When you get to this in other practice, it's not unusual for an attorney, sending a Word document back and forth to say, this is the claim, we're hoping to get a settlement of X, Y, and Z from this. Now, say somehow that gets turned over in the course of the discovery period. If I, go into Word and I click to, show the metadata, suddenly I have an idea of what their settlement wants to be, and then you get into big problems.
Yeah, knowing the other side's private thoughts is obviously pretty devastating in the context of a legal case.
And you have to worry too also about if you're a practicing attorney, that is, you have to worry about attorney-client privileged information that you don't necessarily want to get out to not only the other side, but also out to the public in general, because it's held in confidence.
Right, and there are some privacy issues and professional responsibilities that crop up with that.
So the big deal about metadata, though, is that most of it happens automatically. People don't generally want to, it's not something they affirmatively create. It's something that's created almost as a side effect of using a particular program. Most people who use Microsoft Word probably don't even know that Microsoft Word tracks how many minutes they've spent editing their document or how many paragraphs they once had. So I guess this court decision, they try to make the analogy that metadata is just like somebody who had written this on a paper document, and so the public has the right to know, right? Is that the essence of the court's argument?
Yeah, I believe it is. That all of this is part of that public record, that there's no point in trying to split hairs between, you know, what is a public record and what isn't, when all of this is stored in the public database. All of that was part of the document creation.
But at the same time, like, if I'm writing something by hand, I don't have a stopwatch there, and I'm not going to record, ooh, I spent 25 minutes editing this document, and then write in handwriting 25 minutes editing. Whereas metadata, that happens automatically without necessarily my consent. Or is there sort of an implied consent because I'm using a software that does it even if I don't necessarily know?
I mean, I don't, in at least in the case of public records, I don't think consent has anything to do with it. A public record is a public record. The reason these acts are introduced is, the reason they're passed is to get people better access to, you know, what they're paying people to do. I don't think there's any reason why you'd particularly care about, I shouldn't make this argument because I generally hate it, but it's that, you know, why should they be worried about how many hours or how many minutes or how many paragraphs there was in this originally, unless they're trying to hide something? And
maybe it would be helpful to talk about what a public record is.
Like, sure, but before we go there, I mean, just another quick point is that sometimes I create documents for various purposes, and I start them out of another document that I had before that was tailored for some other type of purpose. And, you know, it was easy for me to modify and adapt that into the use that I wanted for another use that I wanted whatever I had in there for. And if you do that, and if the metadata is captured in the correct way, then in theory, at least portions of that previous document can be now embedded into the metadata of the new document that I just created. So in the context of public records, if somebody is doing something like that for whatever purpose, and it could be for a number of different reasons, and I will immediately admit that that is probably a bad policy to have in any office, regardless of what you do. But it could be the case that the metadata contains information that should not have been disclosed in a public record because of some of the reasons that they listed in the opinion, or it could be entirely unrelated to the record that should be part of the public record. I can think of a number of reasons why that would be a bad idea.
And those reasons are?
Well, you run into the problem then is if the public has the ability to obtain metadata, and if the metadata has things in it that are not necessarily related to the public record, then you're suddenly put in the position of disclosing government information that should not have been previously disclosed. But it has to be disclosed because under the ruling of this court, they're suggesting that metadata is part of the native document itself, and because it's basically the same thing as part of the public, basically because it is part of the public record, it should therefore be disclosed.
So I guess I want to take a step back, and so what is a public record? Like, what might we find as a public record? Like, what sort of document does this ruling even concern?
Something like a disciplinary action. Let's say a police officer is getting written up for some sort of violation. It would be, at least for the police officer, a public record as to, you know, what happened, what statements were made, those kind of things. Official documents from, say, a welfare department making findings about, you know, the state of somebody's home or whether or not, you know, after an investigation it turned out that they really were unemployed or really were searching for employment. It's those kind of things, at least generally. Anybody have anything to add to those?
The court obviously spent a lot of time analyzing this particular point, and I think one of the problems was is that there was not really a good definition of what constituted a public record in the Arizona state law. They did have some guidelines though, and one of them was that we're talking about documents that have some sort of substantial nexus to government activity, and the nature and purpose of the document based on the nature and purpose of the document, you can also determine whether or not it should be something of the public record. However, the court also went on to say that that apparently does not apply to certain types of documents where privacy, confidentiality, or the best interests of the state weigh against the policy in favor of disclosure. But in general, I think the Arizona law that was at issue has just a strong policy background of suggesting open, like an open government type of an environment where you have a lot of disclosure.
Yes, most of these laws have a presumption of disclosability that, you know, there's a presumption. It starts out the court assumes that something will be disclosed, and it's the government's burden to prove that it shouldn't be disclosed, that it falls into one of those exceptions.
So the Arizona Supreme Court even made this ruling because, from what I understand, there was a Phoenix police officer who got demoted, and he wanted to see the metadata about his supervisor's notes to see whether the supervisor had backdated the notes to before the officer's demotion. In other words, his argument was, this guy came up with reasons to fire me after he fired me. I want to see the metadata to see whether that's true.
Right. There were two cases. One involved a school and the other one. The more interesting one, I think, was that one. The one about the demotion. Mm. Now, I don't know the answer to this. Has anybody made an application that goes through and can take, you know, virtually any file type and strip the metadata from it?
Well, I don't know if they exist for any file type, but there are certainly a lot of tools out there where you can strip metadata from documents. I know that Microsoft Word 2007, I think, has at least some function built into it where you can at least eliminate some, if not all, of the metadata within a document itself. There are other ways you could get around some of the metadata. For instance, a common practice in law firms, I hate to go back to the law firm example, but is if you convert a, say, a Word document into a PDF, then that PDF would be stripped of all the metadata that was contained within the Word file.
Yeah. Word 2007 does have an inspect document inspector, which will go through comments, revisions, versions, annotations, document properties, custom XML data, personal information, headers, footers, and watermarks, and hidden text, and then let you remove it all with a button click. So.
Yeah, that seems like that's a useful thing as far as best practices go when you're doing document discovery. You just... If you're really, when you're sending anything out, that's, you know, that you don't need that metadata for. I wonder, I mean, now that I think about it, if I were ever starting a law firm, I would probably want to, you know, put something in the mail filter that took all the documents and unless you, you know, particularly clicked a button to keep the metadata, would strip the metadata out of anything that you sent out.
Indeed, that would be good practice. You do run into an interesting problem, and I haven't thought a whole lot about this, so if you guys want to give me your thoughts, that's good too. But there are laws out there which state that certain entities have to keep electronic records for a certain period of time. And I'm not really sure, but I have a feeling that some of that includes metadata. So you might have to keep some of the metadata that's involved in some of these documents for that period of time.
Right. I wouldn't suggest.
I don't know if you can just go through and say, if you have a document server, for instance, and you have, you know, several terabytes worth of documents from the last 10 years or something like that, I don't know if you could just go through and scrub all of it and say, okay, we're done with all the metadata. It's all gone. You know, there's probably a bunch of other reasons why you don't want to do that, but just on a policy point for disclosure of metadata outside of whatever you're doing, if you didn't want to do that, I think that the electronic storage laws might require you to keep some of that around, but
right,
I don't know.
Right. I wouldn't suggest eliminating all of that metadata. Like you said, it could be very useful. There may be legal reasons why you want to keep it. Certainly, if you're involved in litigation, don't wipe the metadata. You would want to keep the metadata, and, you know, God knows, you know, what would happen if you wiped that metadata. You keep it, but the presumption should be that, at least I feel that, that metadata shouldn't initially be discoverable.
I mean, we're getting into two interesting but different areas here. And one is we're talking about public record disclosure if you're a government entity. And separately, I think what we've now wandered into is whether or not, you know, metadata is discoverable in a normal lawsuit between, say, two citizens, you know, in a civil suit. Both interesting questions. And I would probably be of the opinion that, yes, metadata is most likely discoverable through a civil litigation process, but probably want to get back to the public record.
Yeah, the most interesting cases in the private litigation is where it's accidentally handed over.
Right.
And then does the other lawyer have a right to look at it if he realizes that he shouldn't be looking at it?
Yeah, interestingly enough, with regard to that, whether or not a lawyer should look at it, or even is allowed to look at it if it was accidentally turned over. And this is especially important when it comes to those comments that people leave in things like Word documents. There was at one point, and I don't know if this still is the case, a split between the American Bar Association, what they said was the proper ethical thing to do, and what the New York State Bar said was the proper thing to do. And there are a large number of states who just hadn't ruled on it. So there was a great deal of uncertainty as to, you know, if this kind of stuff falls in your lap, are you supposed to, you know, turn a blind eye and, you know, just shove it back to the attorney and have them deal with it? Or are you allowed to actually, you know, exploit it and, you know, do what's in the best interest of your client and try to learn as much as you can from, you know, somebody else's mistake? Any other thoughts before we wrap this story up and move on?
Also,
What do you guys have any thoughts on whether or not metadata should actually be disclosed, and just in terms of general policy, apart from the opinion, whether or not it should actually be disclosed as part of a public record?
In public records, I think it probably should. In private litigation, I'd lean toward it not being automatically disclosed, but if you have reason to think that it should be disclosed, you can go back and say, and we'd also like the metadata for this. Dominic?
I take the technical elitist point of view and say, if you hand it over, then it's your own damn fault for not knowing how your software works.
But as part of a public record, though?
As part of a public record, again, you should know how your software works. So it should be discoverable. It should be revealed if it's part of the document creation. If you don't like it, don't use software that automatically creates it or set up a system to purge the metadata.
Okay. So our our next case is... No giggling, guys. Our next case is it's a recent, very recent decision. And where was this out of? This was out of the United States District Court for the District of Oregon. A district court judge released an opinion that I wish there were a way to sum this up briefly, but it's a complicated and nuanced case. Essentially, what it said was that if the government is serving a search warrant to find the data, to get emails from you, they don't need to send you personally a notice that they've executed the search warrant. It's enough for them to serve that search warrant and that notice to the person who owns your software. Who runs the software wherever your email is being stored. Does that sound right?
Yep. So, for example, if I have my email at Gmail, the government doesn't need to let me know that they asked Google to see my email.
Right. Now, what makes this case kind of nuanced and complex is that this was not pretty much in any way based on the Fourth Amendment, which is something, it's a misconception that a lot of people have had. Now, there's a lot of academic research that says that you really don't have any expectation of privacy and therefore no protection from the government in your email. Because you're sending your email through lots and lots of servers and because multiple people see it, you may not have that same expectation of privacy that you have in, say, your mail, or it's certainly not the same expectation of privacy you have in the things that are in your house. However, in the 1980s, the U.S. government enacted something called the Stored Communications Act. And what that was a series of rules put in place to protect that information that you have stored on somebody else's servers, or, you know, that somebody else transmits for you. There was actually a fairly interesting case early in the history of this act. Somebody was running a bunch of forums. Do either of you remember the name of this case? I'm totally blanking on it right now. Guy ran some forums. The Secret Service came, seized his computers, and he sued the Secret Service for violating the Stored Communications Act.
It definitely rings a bell, but I can't remember the case name.
Okay. I'll dig that up at some point later in the episode. So, one of the things that the Stored Communications Act says is that you will get a warrant to... You need a warrant to get these documents, and you have to get that warrant pursuant to the procedures of Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 41F. And what the Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure says is you have to get a warrant from a judge, you have to serve a notice on the place to be served, and then in certain cases, when you seize things, you have to send a receipt back. You have to say not only to the judge what you got, you have to tell the person what you seized. And the essential question in this case is whether or not that receipt was required by recent amendments to the Stored Communications Act, and whether or not serving that receipt on the third-party ISP, Internet Service Provider or email provider in this case, was sufficient. And I feel like I am rambling on. And the case is Steve Jackson Games v. Secret Service. Can one of you break it down? And I feel like I just laid a whole bunch of law on the listeners. Can we take this part by part and start breaking apart, you know, what this really means and what the implications of this are?
I think a good place to start is at the end. The judge sort of has a little rhetorical flourish at the end of his opinion that I think is sort of a good perspective of where he's coming from. It's just three sentences, so it's worth reading. Much of the reluctance to apply traditional notions of third-party disclosure to the email context seems to stem from a fundamental misunderstanding of the lack of privacy we all have in our emails. Some people seem to think that they are as private as letters, phone calls, or journal entries. The blunt fact is, they are not.
Right, so third-party disclosure, just to clarify what that is, it's a doctrine of Fourth Amendment search and seizure law that says essentially if I disclose something to a third party, I don't have any reasonable expectation of privacy in it anymore. So I guess to back up one more step, the entire premise of what you need a search warrant for and what you don't need a search warrant for revolves around whether or not you have an objective, society-based, reasonable expectation of privacy. And if you disclose something to a third party, to, you know, some random person, in this case Google, you don't really have that expectation of privacy. Now, the sentences that Dominic just read are widely misquoted because they're significantly broader than the... I mean, they're not misquoted. They're just quoted without the proper context. What the judge seems to be saying there is that there's no reasonable expectation of privacy in emails, which is probably true, but he didn't reach that issue in this case. That seem like an accurate sum up of that, guys?
Sure, and it invites the question, why didn't he reach the issue in this case?
There wasn't any reason to reach the issue in this case because the Stored Communications Act protects it regardless of whether or not there's Fourth Amendment protection.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. I mean, that was sort of the whole premise, as I understand the Stored Communications Act, was sort of to step in and provide an extra layer of protection, so to speak, to people that were using at least two different types of services, the electronic communication services or remote computing services. Both of these things were discussed somewhat at length in the opinion. And it, as I understand it, that part of that act, the Stored Communications Act, protects user data from being read by third parties as it's submitted either to these electronic communication services or remote computing services. The limitation on that, though, is that that does not mean that it is not reachable by means of either a warrant process or some other criminal procedure process to discover upon that information. And the real issue in this case was about notice, and it was about whether or not a notice had to be served upon the person who had actually written emails if a government entity was going to a third-party service provider, rather than going to the user directly himself.
We've heard a lot about this. Could you, Dave, boil down in concisely as possible what the court's ruling was with regard to the notice?
The most succinct way to put it is that they basically said that you do not need to serve a notice upon the user himself. Only sufficient notice was needed to the ISP, just to the ISP.
Right, and at least my reading of that was essentially Rule 41F, going back to, you know, the procedures of getting a search warrant, which have to be followed under the Stored Communications Act, it says you have to serve this notice, this receipt of you know, where you're taking this information from, and you're not taking the information from my house, you're not taking it from my computer, the government is taking it from Google's computer, because that's the easiest place to get it.
Right, that's exactly right, I think, based on what the opinion said.
So I'm a little confused about part of what the judge says. He draws an analogy that, say, you've got a suspect and he leaves some private documents at his mom's house. And the police get a warrant to search his mom's house. And he says that they only need to show a warrant to his mother to get the documents from her house because they're in her house and they have a warrant to search her house. And then the judge sort of draws an analogy that this is somehow not just like Gmail or NetZero or Comcast. Is that?
Yeah, I feel the net zero reference was a little dated, but it's essentially the same thing.
Yeah.
I'm storing these emails in three places, maybe more. I mean, I've got copies of emails on my phone, I've got copies of my email on my computer, I've got copies of email on Google's computer, and I've got a copy of this email on everyone's computer that I sent that email to. I don't see why you need to tell me specifically that you're taking that document when you can go any of those other places to get the document, at least according to the way the statute and the rule are written. I don't think it's right,
well,
per se, but it's what the law says and what's right are so rarely why the same
doesn't
thing.
So why doesn't it trigger the Stored Communication Act in that situation?
In what situation?
The third-party Gmail situation. Like,
it does trigger the Stored Communication Act. In fact, that's what this entire analysis was done. It just, you don't need to serve a notice to me because that's not part of at least the way that the judge is reading the warrant requirement,
right.
the procedural requirement.
So the Stored Communication Act requires a warrant to the third party.
That's at least, and that's what the opinion. I mean, the Stored Communications Act is all about what are the responsibilities then of those third parties who are either facilitating the communication of information across a network or actually storing it there.
Right. I want to clarify one thing. It doesn't require a warrant to the third party. It requires a warrant for that information, and then the government's deciding to serve that warrant to the third party, and they're deciding to do that for a few reasons. One, as I said before, it's going to be easier to get that email from Google, which has, you know, procedures in place to serve up those things and to do it quickly, and they can serve it to Google and then not tell me that they're investigating me, which is good for the investigation, because the longer they can keep the criminal in the dark about the investigation, the better for the criminal. I'm sorry, the better for the government.
In theory, you have to worry about document destruction and things along those lines if some notice is stored upon – I mean some notice is given to the person who's either writing or receiving these emails himself as opposed to the like Gmail, for instance. In theory, I guess, you could worry about the destruction of those emails and then not being able to have reliable evidence for the case.
Right, and that's always a worry, which is, again, one of the reasons why you'd want to keep the criminal in the dark as long as possible. Dave?
But just so I don't sound completely stupid, I mean, when you delete, I mean, as anyone probably now, when you delete some form of data from a hard drive, it's never actually gone unless you've really thoroughly scrubbed it from the disk itself, and, you know, that's a whole other process altogether. You can't control that as a user of Gmail if you try to delete your messages, you know, from the server itself, that they will show as deleted, I think, through your account, but reality is that those that data probably still exists in some form, either as a mirrored backup across a RAID array or something like that, or it's just simply still on the disk itself.
Right. On that note, I want to say there's some FUD going around about exactly how hard you have to try to permanently delete something off your computer. My understanding is that zeroing once is pretty good, and if you do, a lot of computers have an option that you can, you know, zero something three times. You are never going to get a file back if you zero it three times. The problem is that the way most computers are set up is that when you delete a file, it doesn't actually delete the file, it just frees up that block on your hard drive. So all of the data that used to be there is still there, but the hard drive was now free to write over it if it wants to later.
Right. It basically sets a flag and says, overwrite me whenever you need to store something. But it doesn't actually do anything in terms of taking it away. It just deflects it that you can overwrite here.
Yeah, until it's been overwritten several times. I mean, like you mentioned, I think you said three times. I mean, that's probably a reasonable point to assume that that data is somewhat irrecoverable. But I would also assume that there are methods for abstracting some of... I mean, we're talking about magnetic storage for the most part. I guess that's going to change as we move to solid-state drives. But, you know, in terms of magnetic storage, there's probably some way, if you're willing to expend a lot of money on trying to go through a data recovery process, there's probably some way up to some point that you can still recover it even after it's been overwritten a small number of times, once, maybe twice.
That's the thing that I have a little problem with. There was a substantial reward offered for anyone who could extract any type of data off of a drive that was, I think it was zeroed only once. And no one took these people up on their offer. I think you had to pay like $30 for shipping for the drive there and back. And if you could get any information off of it whatsoever, I think you needed the name of one file and one folder off of everything that was on this hard drive, you would get a substantial reward. I want to say it was in the tens of thousands of dollars. It was at the very least $1,000. And nobody took them up on this offer, which leads me to believe that it's significantly more difficult to get zero data off a hard drive than people would have you believe.
I'll buy it. That sounds convincing to me, certainly. But, you know, just like you mentioned now, it's just so we don't get off in too far of a tangent here. I, you know, you the way that most operating systems work today, you know, that at least certainly on Windows or at least Windows XP, that the data is not actually gone. So it's still there until it actually has been physically overwritten.
Yep. Any last thoughts before we move on to the last story?
All set here.
David?
Nope.
Okay. In that case, the last story we have is a big win, and by big we mean $711 million big win for Facebook. Now, Facebook, when was this? They sued a notorious spammer named Sanford Wallace. I'm trying to find a date on this
complaint. June 2009, I think.
I've got February 2009 on the original filing date.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's when he filed for bankruptcy. Yeah, you're probably right with February 2009, I think I read.
Yeah, the docket number is 00798. That's got to be pretty early in the year. So Facebook filed for under several statutes. So the first one is the Can-Spam Act, which is going to be what we're spend the most time talking about. Another claim that they had was essentially a Lori Drew claim under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act that this guy had a Facebook account and violated the terms of the Facebook account. And as a result, he had unauthorized or exceeded his authorized access to Facebook. I don't know what exactly happened with that claim, but and then he had a couple of claims under California state law. But like I said, we're going to spend most of our time talking about the Can-Spam Act. So essentially what happened is this guy, Sanford Wallace, notorious spammer, sent hundreds of thousands of messages, if not more, to Facebook users. And Facebook said, you know what, you're doing this in violation of our terms of service and you're doing it in violation of the law and we're going to crack down, both because our users don't like it and because we don't like it. They sued him. He, as Dave said, declared bankruptcy, and they won a $711 million verdict against him. So let's break down the Can-Spam Act. Can one of you two briefly just tell me, in a nutshell, what the Can-Spam Act is?
Well, it was an act that was promulgated and enacted around 2003, just as the name suggests. And it came out of a series of discussions in the legislature that revolved around the absolute horrid thing that spam is. And a lot of people, when it was enacted, it received a lot of criticism, and people sort of dubbed it the You Can Spam Act rather than the Can Spam Act. And that's because it has a provision, or several provisions in it rather, that say that it's okay to send commercial electronic mail messages as long as you give a way to opt out after the first time that you send an email. And so it provided that there is some sort of opt-out clause within an electronic message that's sent to somebody that essentially comports with the Can-Spam Act. And as long as there's no successive messages that are spent, you know, without the consent of the recipient, then you're complying with the act and you're not necessarily violating it itself. The act also has several other provisions to it, I believe, which just discuss unwanted commercial messages, basically. Do you guys have anything to add to that?
Yeah, well, I want to highlight a couple of things. First of all, it does not prohibit anything about messages that you just send to your friend just talking about stuff. Because of the way the First Amendment works, you can't ban truthful statements like that, you know, or most of those things. What it does specifically is it regulates false emails, emails where you either have a misleading or incorrect subject line, where you falsified some of the header information or the to or from. There's nearly a complete ban on those, as long as they are emails of a commercial purpose. That's an email that's either for the economic benefit of the sender and sender or receiver, or proposing some sort of commercial transaction.
Yeah, basically, so, Can-Spam sort of splits it up into three different types of primary purposes. Like you said, the one being commercial, and the other one, like messaging a friend, would be a transactional or relationship content. And with that one, the only thing they don't allow is falsifying origin information. But for the commercial one, it has the most stringent regulations, and that's probably what you want to talk about, so I'll let you go.
Me or Dave wants to talk about that.
You, because I think I sort of cut in.
Think, and I think you definitely want to talk about it.
Oh, gladly. Hold on, let me pull up the statute so I don't misquote anything. So yeah, like I was saying, there are a bunch of provisions here. So, and these are we'll have a link to this in the show notes. You'll find these at 15 USC section 7701, and from there on out. The first, this is specifically from 7704. You've got a prohibition with regard to commercial emails on false or misleading transmission information, something like headers, something in the from line. You've got a prohibition on deceptive subject headings, and I think this one's a little shaky as to, I mean, I don't, it seems like a stupid thing to prohibit. I think it's totally fine, you know, as far as legality goes. I don't think there's any problem prohibiting a deceptive subject heading. It just seems a little weird to criminalize that as opposed to other things. But
well, you know, interestingly, I think they got at one of the tactics that some of the spammers use, and that's they purposely apply misleading subject headings to make them look like they're legitimate emails versus non-legitimate, or, you know, excuse me, so to make them look like they're not commercial emails, but instead to make them look like they're legitimate emails.
So I open the thing that says, "Oh, hi, Ben, long time no see."
Sure, or in regards to the meeting earlier or something like that, to make it look like it, you know, was a business email, because if you have a work email, it's not uncommon that you get email messages from names that you don't necessarily recognize, but they're still pertinent to whatever it is that you're doing. The whole purpose is to get you to click to open it up to see the commercial message that's inside.
Okay, that's fair. I was thinking of, you know, subject that promised one thing, but it, you know, wouldn't deliver like the best prices you've ever seen. I guess that would be puffery. That probably wouldn't be actionable. But is there anything, any areas of this that you guys specifically want to touch on?
Well, I'm sorry, I feel like I cut you off there, Dominic. But one of the more interesting things I thought was just thinking about how different Facebook is from some of the other more traditional mediums that you might receive spam. And since Facebook, and this is, I think, at least in my opinion, one of the reasons that Facebook became so popular so many years ago was that it's more of a closed system, and that it has a lot of security layered on top of the profiles that you can create in there. So you don't receive messages from people that you don't necessarily know, or you can at least filter them out so that you receive them in a certain way, but those people can't view your profile page, they can't post on your wall, and et cetera. So one of the things that the court discussed a lot in this was that it's so effective if somebody can seize control of somebody else's account and use that account then to post wall messages across multiple profiles at the same time, then it's more likely because the recipient of the wall message would then view the spam because it looks like it's coming from somebody legitimate that they knew, and it was, and Facebook's more of a trusted platform in terms of security, so it was more likely to pass through without the scrutiny of a typical user, I guess.
Wasn't there a case a while ago where some guy had his Facebook account compromised by someone in Europe, and the guy posted, "Help, I'm stranded in country, wire money to this account," and people actually did, and it was someone who had just stolen his Facebook account?
Wow, that's impressive.
I would not be surprised, but...
I don't remember hearing about that.
My point is that there's a high level of trust with regard to Facebook, so because people assume that it's legitimate because of the safeguards.
Yeah, that's interesting. On a side note, but at the same time related, I don't know if either of you guys saw it, but the technically legal Twitter account got a direct message from David Latt today. David Latt's, he's one of the editors of, I want to say, the Wall Street Journal Law blog? Or is he above the law?
I don't know. That's a good question. I know I've heard his name before, and it sounds like Wall Street Journal. But
yeah, somebody had hijacked his Twitter account and sent a spam on Twitter through a direct message from him. So
very nice.
It was very clearly spam, so I didn't click on it. But anyway,
Twitter would be one of those platforms where you're more likely to get spam on it these days, I think.
Yeah, but I mean, but, you know, would expect to get spam from a non-trusted account, not from somebody who's relatively trusted, who's a face. He's on above the law, by the way.
Above the law, okay. So yeah, and interestingly, I mean, I've actually received over the last couple of years, I've probably received a dozen or so spam messages in the way that the complaint alleges against Sanford Wallace on Facebook. Through not they weren't always wall postings, but actually some of them probably were like wall postings or they were direct messages across Facebook. But you know, it does happen.
Yeah. One of the other things I wanted to mention, and this is something that you will see in legitimate, I dare say legitimate spam that you'll get, and it's a result of the Can Spam Act, is that you've got to have that unsubscribe button. And when you click that, it'll often say, you know, it may take up to 10 business days for your request to go through, and that's directly from the statute that it only prohibits. So once you click the unsubscribe, you've got 10 days to actually unsubscribe them. And that's
right.
one of the caveats, which I think is the stupidest caveat in this entire law. There's no reason why it should take you 10 days to take somebody out of an email system like that.
Well, they don't want to hurt the business owner who maintains his entire or her entire email list by hand.
Yes, that's a concern. That is definitely a concern that people have.
There are people like that.
Dominic, do you have an email list that you're not telling us about?
No. I'm just saying that it's an artifact of the way laws are made in this country where you have to satisfy pretty much every possible interest group that weighs in.
Yeah, so. I'm sure somebody came to Congress saying, well, you know, this is so burdensome, you know, you can't have us immediately unsubscribe these people.
Yeah,
it takes time to do these things.
Direct marketers were particularly concerned about the Can Spam Act when it was being originally written because they did not want to get their entire line of direct marketing via email shut down by this legislation because they consider themselves just a legitimate business and they're not spammers. They're actually just trying to market directly to your email account. So the distinction is a fine one, but it's nonetheless there because they are selling legitimate products as opposed to scams. So
right.
Even despite this law, though, which does have at least having the ability to opt out of commercial email is, I think, at least great by itself. That said, though, there's plenty of times where I've purchased either products or services from across the internet and specifically went through the checkboxes and made sure I had none of them checked. So, you know, or I had not opted into any commercial email. And sure enough, like a month or two later, boom, I've got like 5 commercial emails from the company that I just purchased.
Maybe you didn't read the checkbox properly. Maybe it said, uncheck this box if you don't want to not receive communication requests.
Yeah. Oh, that's a great point, because I mean, they can make it as confusing as possible, and so you know.
Like a triple negative. Which way do you parse that? So,
yeah. On that note, I mean, there's some spam that I like getting. You know, there are certain, you know, electronics companies I like getting emails from them to see if there are any great deals that are going on. One that I did not appreciate. Sorry, David.
I was gonna say messages from Steve Jobs and
etc. I actually I do get all of those Apple emails whenever they send a product. Like the following day, I get an Apple spam from them. I'm like, yeah, no, I knew about it, but it's okay. I don't mind you guys. But I bought something online from Best Buy, and literally the second I gave them my email address and clicked, you know, confirm this, I got a spam message from them saying, by the way, these are some, you know, TV shows that you also may like to buy. I'm like, are you kidding me? I have never unsubscribed from something that quickly. That was just a clear abuse of my email address. Before we wrap this up, does anybody have any last thoughts on the Can Spam Act?
No. Go ahead, Dominic.
I'm happy that it's actually being enforced and it's proving a somewhat effective weapon against spam because there was a lot of doubt when it came out early on that it would be effective. And it's good to see that this case, and there were some early cases as well, I think Facebook won $873 million against someone else for sending sleazy messages. So it's good to see that it's at least somewhat effective considering how there was a lot of moaning when it first came out that, oh, well, this is a You Can Spam Act, as we mentioned earlier. So
yeah, I mean,
yeah, this is not a law that I've really followed very closely, to be honest, but I did notice on the, at least I think it went to the Wikipedia posting on it, it said that there had been hundreds or thousands of lawsuits over the since its enactment, and most of those have been settled out, so I assume that people are then using it effectively, hopefully.
Yeah, I mean, my biggest problem that I have with the Can Spam Act isn't one that the United States can really solve with this act or any other act. It's the totally illegitimate messages, it's the, you know, the scam messages, it's the phishing messages that are either sent by, you know, bot networks or sent by somebody who's out of the country, and we just don't have any any power to, you know, do anything about it. And those are really the most pernicious, I think. But it is nice to see some bad guys getting, you know, if not criminal penalties, significant civil penalties from this kind of action.
Thankfully, most of the web-based email these days, or at least Gmail, is fairly good at filtering out most of the spam. I don't really get a whole lot of spam on Gmail, and or at least on one of my Gmail accounts, which I have a lot of email addresses filter into it. So.
Okay. Well, in that case, we would like to thank you all for joining us for this Technically Legal podcast. You can always visit our website at www.technicallylegal.org. You can email us about the podcast at podcast@technicallylegal.org, or you can follow us on Twitter at @TechLegal. So signing off for the night, I'm Ben Snitkoff.
Dominic Gravier.
And David O'Brien.
Thanks for listening.